Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Baltimore positive. We're positively going to be taking the show on the road. We're going to have a fun time. It's going to be Orioles-Yankees, the rubber match. We're going to be at Costas at 4 o'clock today. If you are hearing this, if you're hearing this tomorrow, we're not going to be there today. We were there yesterday. It is a big weekend of baseball. Birds are heading down to Houston. Certainly everybody on their screens on Wednesday night. I've called this I made a mistake of calling it, what did I call it? Crucial, key, must win. I called it something, really pissed Luke off on way. It's just a series in June. And if you blow a 5-1 lead late in the game, it's not a deal, especially if you win in extra innings. Luke Jones joins us now. It's all brought to you by the Maryland Lottery. I have scratch offs, the double rush sevens doublers we'll have at Costas on Thursday. We'll also have our friends with Jiffy Lube MultiCare, as well as Liberty Pure Solutions, putting us back on the road on Tuesday when we'll be at Pappas in Parkville. Long baseball games that have that late starting time of 7:05, keeping us up late, then playing extra innings. How dare they blow a lead like that in the Bronx and scare everyone? And by the way, how dare the Yankees throw at our best players? And how dare there not be a brawl? And I sat here yesterday for 45 minutes and predicted a brawl, and the only reason there wasn't a brawl is because the Orioles didn't want one. That's a fact.
Because the Orioles are grown-ups. I mean,
fair enough.
The Yankees lead the American League in hit by pitch. Look how many Orioles they've hit since this season series began back.
So when
in
do you
April.
Do something about it as the baseball team? I'm not calling for fight.
They did. They
I'm
beat them. They beat them. That's how you do something about it. You're speaking in the old school of throwing objects that can alter people's careers.
I'm speaking in the way that it always has worked, and the way that
has it.
If Jim Palmer was there, it's the way he would have been thinking about it. But
okay,
that's just the way. How many guys are you going to let him plunk? I mean,
I'm not
speaking as the brawler. I'm usually in your seat. I'm just saying I'm shocked that it didn't come to that when you're throwing at our phenom. That's all. That's it.
I mean, well, but I'm going back to just the soft reaction from the Yankees about Aaron Judge being hit, acting like Albert Suarez, who walked five guys that night, who got ahead 0-2 on Aaron Judge, who did not hit Juan Soto, the batter before, who was the one who did the most suspicious thing of all on Tuesday night, running into Jordan Westberg on a random grounder. I mean,
dude, I'm not with Locke and Fora on Twitter on this because JT the Brick and he were fighting because he's a Yankee the other night. I'm not the guy for the fights. I'm for the you are throwing at Gunnar Henderson. That those weren't purpose pitches on Wednesday night. They were designed to hit our player. I agree with you that Aaron Judge
right.
was
I'm just okay, but then so you retaliate and then there's a brawl and then you get guys suspended and then you're pitching. Who knows? You might lose some other pitchers then, and you're already losing pitchers. I mean, I think
I'll
they're being
hear
babies.
Brandon Hyde's thought on that. I think
they're being babies about it. I mean, like, it's that simple. So you can either you know, they go low, you go lower. Okay, what does that solve? I mean, they beat them.
If these teams played 19 times a year, there'd definitely be trouble down the line. They might be able to get out of there by 7 o'clock tonight and forget about it. But I don't think these guys ever forget about it. It's baseball.
Oh, I mean, I'm not denying that there won't be more to the story at some point. I mean, I think that's absolutely a distinct possibility, if not a very likely possibility. But look,
don't fight. Throw back at their heads. That's baseball. And that's what happens when pitchers don't bat too, by the way. That's part and parcel. We'll go back to Drysdale and Gibson with that.
Fair enough. But I'll still go back to, you know, I look at Juan Soto as being the guiltiest of all in this series as far as anything we saw. I think him running into Jordan Westberg was way more suspicious than anything else that happened.
Well, he started the whole stare down 3 months ago, which is where the whole thing started again. So Soto running the guy over was part of that's my stare. That's my Latino, my machismo. You know, it's all of that. Like, Soto started this. There's no question about that.
I mean, I just, you know.
And there's no question there's bad blood. And for you, we can talk about the baseball game. We will, and Kimbrel and all that. But the bad blood is going to supersede any of this, given the stakes of the season. It's different when Armando Benitez is fighting with Tino Martinez 5 years after it wasn't 5 years, but
it was a year after, yeah.
Good teams and bad teams. These are both really good teams. And when it's a good team and a bad team, it's different if you're throwing at the 118 loss Orioles than if you're throwing at the 101 win Orioles.
Yeah. I mean, The way I view it at this point in time, and look, if the Yankees want to fight, there's going to be a fight at some point. But the way I view it is, okay, you threw at Gunnar. You're mad about Aaron Judge the previous night. Look, he's okay. He's going to be okay. He missed Wednesday's game, but it seems like there's a chance he could play, you know, at some point in the next couple of days. It's not going to be a long-term absence. You hit Gunnar, great. It's over then, right? Can we move forward as grown-ups?
Then they hit Couser.
That one, I don't think that one was remotely it. That would have made no sense if that one's on purpose. The Gunnar Henderson one, yeah. At that point in time, what it was 4-1, 5-1, 4-1 going on 5-1, getting relatively late in the game. And by the way, that run ended up being pretty big, right? So I don't think the Couser won. I think that was legitimately, I don't think
Got
that was,
away.
yeah, because the game situation. That made zero sense then. Just like I was talking about how the previous night he got ahead 0-2 on Aaron Judge. You're not trying to hit him. You're trying to get him out at that point. Suarez kept walking people. He didn't have his good command. Anyway, the thing I wanted to talk about, because that will be there, and look, we can sit here and speculate about it for an hour, and the ESPN talking head shows of the sports world will talk about that because it's juicy, mindless content, quite frankly, in my opinion. But I think Wednesday will turn out to be a very significant inflection point in this season in a few different ways. One, big win for the Orioles, right? We were talking about this. We talked about this going into the series. The one outcome that the Orioles couldn't afford, even though certainly not going to sit here and say the division race is over if you're swept, but you don't want to be in that position where you lose three straight and you're now in a position where the Yankees are really starting to open up some space in the AL East. So that's one point. Second point, and we talked about this generally speaking as far as the expectation, but Mike Elias speaking at Yankee Stadium prior to Wednesday's game, Kyle Bradish has undergone Tommy John surgery, out for the year, out for probably most of next year, I think a best case scenario. And you can actually look at a very similar timeline. Jacob deGrom of the Texas Rangers underwent Tommy John surgery right around this time last year. He is hoping for an August return. That's kind of the hope for him, August, maybe September. That's what we're looking at with Kyle Bradish at this point in time. So we were talking about the starting rotation already. This wasn't shocking. This felt inevitable from the time Friday night happened, and certainly when he went on the IL on Saturday. But official, Kyle Bradish out for the season. They need another starting pitcher. We can sit here and debate who it's going to be, what level of quality. Is it going to be a number one? No, it's
And
not
it's not
number
Cade
one at all.
Povich in your mind.
Well, I mean, I think Cade Povich can be part of the solution. And look, this isn't just, we need to stop thinking about this solely in terms of October, because you need to navigate the season to get to
Right.
that
It's
point.
like we could say, well,
Right.
Suarez, Irvin, and we'll figure this kid out.
He
We'll
can
do
be
this.
part of
We'll do this
that.
for a month or two, but then somebody else is going to tweak something. And Kramer's going to come back. I mean, Kramer's starting this
Right.
weekend, too.
Right. So, but this goes back to what you were saying in terms of looking through the lens of who's your number three starter in October. And we're making the assumption that Corbin Burns is okay the rest of the way, that Grayson Rodriguez is okay the rest of the way. And these are the assumptions every team makes. So that's
And it
just
is
part of it,
June. It
right?
is June. There's a lot of
Right.
baseball left, right?
And that's the thing. Gerrit Cole just came back. Great for the Yankees, right? But is Gerrit Cole going to be okay? Are his elbow injury issues completely behind him? So there's always that. But with the finality of Bradish now, knowing he's not going to be back, also understanding what I just said, Nestor, you need to be thinking in terms of next year too. If we're working under the assumption right now, and I'm going to, until I see ownership spend any money, and let alone talking about how I've acknowledged that it's a very slippery slope trying to give any pitcher of that ilk the kind of contract that Corbin Burns is going to command, and whether that's a good long-term investment, regardless of what your payroll is. That's a debate. That's a debate. That's a fair question. So
Somebody's got to pitch.
this isn't just Kyle Bradish missing next year. This is also thinking about the future of Corbin Burns and whether he's going to be here next year. So
Yeah, your
you're looking.
number one starter next year is a gray shadow box right now for April for of next year, right?
I mean,
Organizationally.
by default, it would be Grayson Rodriguez, which, look, Grayson Rodriguez is really good and still has more meat on the bone in terms of upside, but you've got to have more than that. Even if he becomes a bona fide one, you still need someone that's going to be a heck of a number two, right? So I think this trade deadline isn't just about the rest of 2024. I think it's Can you acquire the kind of pitcher of that ilk that could slot into the top two or three spots of your rotation, who's also under club control for next year? You know, I think that becomes much more relevant now. And again, that talking point was there, but now
that's
with
a
the
bigger
official
price in your trade price tag too, right?
It is.
You're looking to shop somewhere that's going to cost you another Ortiz. It's going to cost you a real player.
Yeah, and look, I mean that. And we could debate whether that was going to be what they should do anyway, because again, not knowing if Corbin Burns is going to be here and the likelihood that he probably isn't, right? Just knowing how these things typically work. So you have that. So that's my other point. Other thing, Danny Coulomb, bone chips in his elbow removed. It sounds like they're optimistic he can be back by September, but that doesn't leave you much wiggle room in terms of any kind of a minor setback, any issue that he might have just in rehabbing. I mean, if you remember, John Means last year had a back issue creep up during his long-term elbow rehab just because, hey, you still need to work other parts of your body and things happen. So I think between that and then what we saw from Craig Kimbrell on Wednesday night, I've talked about this a little bit in passing. I mentioned this on social media as the ninth inning was going on Wednesday night. Craig Kimbrell now is 0 for 4 in save situations where he has entered with a one-run lead. Think about that. We are almost to July, and Craig Kimbrell does not have a one-run save under his belt. That he has one, technically. It's when he went into the game in Anaheim, and he had a two-run lead. Now, it was an unearned run. It wasn't his fault, but he entered that game with a two-run lead. That is his only one-run save all year. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean Craig Kimbrell stinks. Craig Kimbrell doesn't stink. We need to understand there's a range of outcomes here, right? There's a range of outcomes between being what Felix Bautista was pre-injury last year, which is as good as it gets, and, you know, Craig Kimbrell, what he was for that two-week period earlier this season where it was kind of a disaster, right? So he's been pretty good, right? He's been really good at times, but I continue to see someone who, to me, screams more of a situational closer. And what I mean by that is when the elements are more favorable, meaning he has a two or a three run lead and he's not pitching three times in 4 days, you know, looking at it through that lens, if the conditions are more favorable, Craig Kimbrell's done a good job this year, but at some point in time, you're going to be playing more one run games. You know, it's inevitable, right? They haven't played quite as many that haven't been quite as frequent as far as one run games go. So he hasn't been tested as much in that way. And that's a testament to the club and their overall quality. But my point, and this is why I've kind of been saying this, and you and I've debated this going all the way back to spring training, that I've felt all along that they're going to need another high leverage arm with either closer experience or that kind of an ability that when it's a really tight game that you feel really good about that guy. And it doesn't mean that Craig Kimbrell is demoted.
And by the way, that's not Cano. We thought that might have been Cano.
No,
right?
I don't
we
think
thought that was Cano in spring training. Like, that would be the other guy,
right,
if anything happened to Kimbrell. I don't think we feel that. We feel differently about Cano this June than we did last June.
I mean, it's just – and Wednesday was another example. When he comes into the game with guys on base – and look, I understand ideally – for anyone, it's going to be better when you start with a clean inning, right? But that's not reality.
That's you're not
going
the 10th to... inning any.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, right, exactly, right. If you're going to pitch in extra innings, especially in this day and age, at least, you know, October doesn't have that rule, but a regular season does. But I've said this for a while now. Look, this bullpen is good. We can't ignore the numbers. They've gotten the job done. They've done a really good job considering some of the challenges they've had, namely Felix Bautista not walking through that door for the entire season. But I've said this, you know, I've made this point to you at a few different points. I look at everyone in this bullpen and I feel like everyone would be better if they were slotted one spot or two spots lower than what they are in the pecking order right now. And what I mean by that is, you know, Yennier Cano, I'd feel much better about if he's more 7th/8th inning guy than 8th/9th inning guy. Craig Kimbrell, I'm not even saying I would take Craig Kimbrell out of the closer's role. You know how I'm non-traditional when it comes to a closer. And maybe that means I'm traditional because I'm thinking about it more through the lens of how things used to be years and years and years ago. And what I mean by that is, you know, I don't need Craig Kimbrell to be my automatic, no questions asked, he pitches the ninth inning every save situation kind of guy. I'd really like to find another guy that kind of makes whoever the new guy would be, 1 and 1A in terms of that guy and Kimbrel. And, you know, Kimbrel would get some save situations, but if it's a one-run game and the heart of the order's due up for the opposition, I might be going with the other guy because he, you know, has a little more consistency, a little more upside at this point. Maybe he's younger, presumably. I don't know.
Well, you're also going to be playing back-to-back nights. So second night, you'd never bring Kimbrel right. if he had a better option. And that would make him better.
Right, right. I mean, that's the whole thing. This whole thing is about if you can bump everyone down one spot in the pecking order, and I'm talking through the lens of
all
like,
you want is a Batista replacement that's not Batista, but better than Kimbrel.
Easier said than done, though, and that's part of the challenge that Mike Elias faces. That's why he spent the money on Craig Kimbrel to begin with, because it's like, okay, who are you going to bring in? You know that Craig Kimbrel, or not Craig Kimbrel, Felix Batista, there aren't many guys out there like him. And we could talk about Mason Miller, you know, Oakland's reliever, and you know a few other guys here and there, but what's the cost going to be?
And that's going to be an interesting bidding war when that happens, because the Orioles aren't the only ones that need this help.
Right, and that's the you just said it. I mean, everyone needs bullpen help. Everyone could use more arms in the bullpen. I mean, the Yankees, who have a really good bullpen, would absolutely take another bullpen arm. Cleveland, who has an excellent bullpen, would absolutely take another bullpen arm. So that's where this is challenging, and that's where you look at it. But I think Wednesday, and I gave you a multi-pronged explanation for why I feel Wednesday could be such a turning point. And I'll throw another one out there, and this is more of a big picture issue that you and I will talk about more and more. We've talked about it in passing, but at some point in time, especially with what we're seeing now, knowing that Bradish done for the year, John Means done for the year, Tyler Wells done for the year, and all those guys, including Means, and obviously Means is a pending free agent, so that's a little bit of a different argument, but they're all going to miss at least a portion of next year as well. So I'm looking at ownership at this point in time. And why I'm looking at ownership is saying Mike Elias and this front office has reached an inflection point. We talked about this a little bit last year at the trade deadline, and we talked about it at some point in time, they're going to need to start spending more money, and whether it's talking about keeping their own players, whether it's talking about augmenting this club. And what I mean by this is, yes, you're going to have to trade prospects. And yes, you might have to trade a couple more prospects than you were hoping to have to trade.
And take on salary.
Well, that's the big part of this, though. I want to see ownership, and I'm talking about David Rubenstein here. I'm talking about this new ownership.
We have a long history going back to Craig Lefferts and Lonnie Smith. Dude, I can go back into the Wayback Machine before Angelos owned the team about how cheap they were and then how cheap Angelos was in this particular case forever as far as augmenting things, you know? And being able to shop from the top shelf as well as sign free agents from the top shelf. This organization didn't have a sniff at the sheriff, and he grew up down the street, and they made up lies about what they were going to offer. And like all this stuff that I'm supposed to ignore when the Whistler and Mr. Rubenstein call me about my press pass, that none of this ever happened. It all happened. And this organization, I don't want to say never, but I, you know, go back to 97 and 96 and 97 when players were flying everywhere and David Wells and like all of that. They shopped then. Everybody was shopping then. I mean, Tigers were spending money. Everybody was spending like drunken sailors at that point in the mid 90s, trying to get players and trying to win. Still more owned by like guys like Steinbrenner than it was like corporate entities or the Tribune company owning the Cubs. But the Orioles have never shopped like that. The Orioles have never taken on the Verlander in August who still owed $10 million over 2 months. They've just never done that. I don't know who's out there. I don't know what the numbers would even be, but the Orioles haven't done that. The Orioles have always sort of bottom fished at the trading deadline financially. I'm talking.
Well, but I'm not even I'm talking in a bigger picture sense even from that. I mean, yes, the trade deadline for that, but also some of this is Mike Elias might need to trade more from his farm system than he would have liked a month ago. And if you're going to do that, then you want to hear the commitment from ownership to say, Mike, we're going to be expanding the payroll. You know, we're not going to be spending like the Dodgers, but We're going to spend more than we have the last.
I would think behind closed doors, and I don't know what Rubenstein even knows about baseball. I'm pretty convinced he doesn't know much about baseball. I think he held the bat the wrong way in the promo. Like, I'm at the point where he's a figurehead throwing out hats like Mr. Magoo. I don't think he's really running it. I don't think he's here. I don't think he's ever coming here to run it. And so knowing baseball players and who's good to trade for, and Mike, that's a good idea. I wonder where they are behind closed doors, and I'll never know because I'll never be invited in anymore, on where they are on Burns, whether they feel about Burns the way you and I do, or whether Rubenstein's Mr. Big Pants and says, we're going to sign him. We're going to put $300 million up for a pitcher, and we're going to figure out Henderson, and we're going to sell more sleeve patches, and we're going to get our TV. Like, I don't know their level of confidence because I haven't met them. I've just met some prick on the phone who whistles or yelled at me. I don't have any ability to know what their real intentions are. And to your point, you know, 6 weeks from now, we'll at least question it. I don't know if we're going to question Mr. Rubenstein. I don't know that Elias is ever going to be honest about it. But I've sat here for 30 years and watched it. Mr. Rubenstein, I want baseball team. I want to be a hero. I want to sign autographs. I want people to know who I am. That's what Rubenstein has signed up for. He jets in. They put him on television doing a papal wave. But I don't know what philosophically any of this is, because it's big boy pants, dude. It was always big boy pants when we were poor and losing 120 games, when teams would go out on July 3rd and say, we're going to take on $60, $80 million of a player because we're going to have that pitcher for the next 2 or 3 years, and we need a one, and we're not going to have Burns. Now, I know Elias is a genius. I just don't know what Rubenstein's up to. I'm not even convinced, and I'll say this out loud, I'm not convinced he owns the team. I'm convinced that the Angelos family still has their 60% of the stock. I haven't said that out loud. I've believed that for a couple of weeks. I believe that. So I don't think this is about Mr. Rubenstein, because I don't think he owns the team yet.
I mean, that part of it, I don't know. But what I will say is, again, there's a very wide range of outcomes here. And my big question is the financial commitment coming to increase payroll, make things easier, create a wider margin for error with having to trade some prospects to go get what you need, to go out in the free agent market this off season and go get what you need? And if that's there, then they're going to be fine navigating where they are right now with the pitcher injuries. If that's not there and it continues to have to be the farm system, and maybe you can sign one, I don't want to say modest, because it sounds crazy saying that, because, you know, what Corbin Burns is making real money this year. Kyle Gibson made some real money last year, but relative to what payroll and what contracts can be, you know, one-year deals are not major commitments. So if that's still going to be what you're limited to do in doing, then this does get way more difficult, and you are operating from a really tiny margin for error, and you are having to obsess on the margins for how you're trying to get better. So like I said, I mean, it's, and again, this isn't, you know, to the example that you just made, this isn't me saying that you must go out and acquire a pitcher who's owed $60 million still over the next couple years. For me, it's understanding that those pitchers could be out there for you if you are willing to take on some salary, and if your general manager, and this is the key, I mean, everything you said about David Rubenstein, I don't need him to make the baseball decisions. I don't even need him to necessarily understand it a whole lot. I need him to trust his baseball people and say, look, Mike, Sig, Matt Blood, everyone, you know, all the movers and shakers and decision makers within their front office, you know, that are evaluating, I want you guys to know that I trust you implicitly from a baseball decision-making standpoint. At the same time, I want you to understand that you don't have to operate as you did in the old world. And if there's something that you think can make us much better, but we need to spend to do it, then I'm here to make that happen. You know, that's what I want to hear is on the table. And again, that doesn't, I'm not necessarily saying that that means you're signing Corbin Burns to a 7-year contract for whatever crazy 9-figure deal he's going to ultimately get. And when I say crazy, I don't mean that it's, you know, bad or that he's not deserving of it. It's just what the market would dictate. And knowing what that market is for top of the rotation starting pitchers hitting free agency. But you know, that's the unknown here. You know, we talked about this a lot. You know, last year we talked about this at the trade deadline. We talked about it last offseason in terms, you know, amidst ownership uncertainty, but talking about this farm system getting them to this point, which is a really, really impressive point. I mean, 101 wins last year, on pace to do better than that this year. But at some point in time, if the financial commitment isn't coming to augment and re-sign guys, then you have to operate more like the Tampa Bay Rays. And look, that's worked really well for the Rays relative to what resources they've had or resources they haven't had. But it's also really difficult to get over the hump when that's those are the restrictions that you're working with. So for me, again, it's a case of, does ownership say to Mike Elias, Mike, we can trade an extra prospect or two to land what we need because we're going to be spending more. We're going to be more of a player on the free agent market. That doesn't mean we're necessarily going to give out $300 million contracts on the norm, but we're not going to be bottom three in Major League Baseball on payroll anymore either. So if that's there, then I think Mike Elias has more confidence and more conviction to go out and get a couple pieces that can help you this year and presumably next year and you know whatever club control or contractual control you have. But if that assurance isn't there, and again, you're just kind of using your farm system to acquire what you need, then that just limits you so much more in terms of right now and in terms of the long-term sustainability of this thing. So I don't say this even looking through the lens of saying I don't expect that that's going to be on the table, but until it is, we don't know. And that's where we look at this and say, you know, the last thing I want to see them do is, you know, completely pick their farm system clean just to acquire a couple guys that might marginally increase your chances of winning in October. I want to see them make deals that make sense while they can also maintain their long-term health of the organization. But again, how does payroll fit into that? If you are going to have the flexibility to spend more, then you can have more confidence in maybe giving up that one extra prospect if you feel like you're going to land something that's really good. Because then you say, hey, this guy that projected to be at this position and this year and doing this
Burns
for
is a great example, but they gave up something out of strength that they couldn't have used. Ortiz wouldn't have been on this team anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, D.L. Hall's been hurt, right? I mean, D.L. Hall would have been in their bullpen, but would he have stayed healthy? I mean, that was kind
of the
knock.
They didn't like D.L. Hall. It's obvious. That's something
I mean, they liked him. They didn't love him to the point where they wouldn't part with him for Corbin Burns, right? I mean, you like your guys. They like Joey Ortiz. But yeah, where was the path to playing time for him? So again, is the commitment financially coming for Mike Elias to have the confidence to say, yeah, if I need to give up one more prospect than our models say we should, but we feel like we can maximize our win probability in the playoffs this year and also put ourselves in better position next year when we're probably going to lose Corbin Burns and we're not going to have Kyle Bradish till August at best, then those decisions aren't easy, but they become easier to navigate. So that's part of it. So I think we're going to look back on Wednesday. You know, the Bradish news was inevitable, but it became official. Danny Coulomb, disappointing. We'll see if he's back in September. Not saying he won't be, but there's a lot of unknown there. And like I said with Craig Kimbrell, I mean, Kimbrell's been good overall, and the numbers bear that out, but he's really been the benefactor of some pretty favorable save situations. And look, that's a reflection of how good this club is. The fact that he saved 2 and 3 run games rather than 1 run games on the norm. You know, it's easier to win 2 and 3 run games. Newsflash there, right? You know, you don't have to be a math major to figure that out. But you're going to have to save more 1 run games. And we're just not, you know, Craig Kimbrell's not inspiring a lot of confidence in doing that, which is why I said this isn't about demoting him. This isn't about that he stinks or anything like that. It's about, can you add another arm into that mix that you feel really good about throwing out there in the ninth inning? And that individual can save some games. And look, Craig Kimbrell, when it's a 2 or 3 run game, can still save those games, right? I mean, you can have a 1 and 1A. I am not the type that subscribes to the idea that you must have the same guy closing games for you every night. I think it's, you need some individuals who can handle that. I don't think you just throw any random reliever out there in the ninth inning either. Let's be clear. But I think there's another move And that's not to say they don't need to add two relievers, but I think one of them at the very least has to be someone that absolutely is a real serious factor in the ninth inning. And then that eases some of the of Kimbrel's responsibilities when it's the highest of high leverage. That eases Yennier Cano to maybe pitch a little bit earlier in some games. That eases Jacob Webb, who's pitched really, really well for them overall. I mean, that helps, you know, that you can slot everyone down a peg. And I think that makes a bullpen that's done admirable work. You know, this bullpen's done a really good job. The numbers don't lie. We can't just ignore it just because, well, they missed Felix Bautista and they missed this guy and they missed that guy. Oh, they must stink.
Oh, we think it could be better.
Right. It could be better. That's fair. Right. I mean, this is what I'm proposing. I've said that all along. At the same time, I'm recognizing that their pitching is among the best in baseball. We can't just ignore
but
that.
We're on borrowed time around here. You know that, Lou.
I mean, to a degree, sure. But
when you don't see Means and Bradish and even Colom at this point, Wells,
the reinforcements aren't there, right?
You know, the guys that were in the organization that we talked all winter about, all last summer about, it's getting a little depleted. It's good. All I said to my wife when you were doing the press conference and Twitter, I said, it's a good thing they got Burns. Yeah, it's a good thing they got, because their season would have been over if they didn't have Burns.
Sure.
The trade of Ortiz and the trade of DL Hall saved their season. Corbin Burns has saved their season.
And this is where,
because they'd be 11 games out right now. They'd just be another team slapping around trying to get a wild card game.
Yeah, they'd be a wild card contender at this point. You know, their season wouldn't be over through the lens of making the playoffs or any of that, but it'd be much more of a Cinderella kind of thing.
Who's your number one starter in October too? Yeah, right. Okay, Cole Irvin's going game one. Okay,
well, great.
You know, like, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like,
I know what you're saying. Well, and this is
that trade and the vision for that trade, and it was a blockbuster. It happened playoff week for the Ravens. It happened after the Rubenstein, like that. If I'm writing the book on Orange Kool-Aid, or I'll come up with that. What I won't use orange. I'll use a synonym for orange, like lavender for purple. But if I were to write the book, the Burns trade is close to the front. If they win a World Series this year, they could not have done that without him. They were not equipped to do that, knowing what we now know.
Well, and that's the big thing here. Kyle Bradish, the UCL sprain surfaced in late January. They acquired Corbin Burns on February 1st. Now, Mike Elias, you know, in talking about the trade, said that that's something that, you know, they were targeting a frontline starting pitcher, but did they up their offer, up what they were willing to part with, knowing that Kyle Bradish was a question mark at that point in time, knowing not necessarily thinking he wasn't going to pitch, but when you, anytime you have a pitcher with an elbow issue, you know that it's a question. So, yeah, and that's why I kind of said to you at this point in time, they're kind of, sort of, not exactly, but not far off, kind of where their rotation was last year, with basically swapping Corbin Burns for Kyle Bradish. Now, I'd like to have both. Kyle Bradish is a top of the rotation quality kind of arm when he's right. But can they go out and do better than Jack Flaherty? I think that's, you know, that's a captain obvious statement. Although Jack Flaherty's pitching really well for Detroit this year, so who knows? Maybe they were on to something and it just didn't come to fruition. But big win on Wednesday night. Really a testament to this team's resolve, considering how that game went, considering the disappointment of the news from earlier in the afternoon. But I think we're going to look back on Wednesday night in a lot of different ways in terms of not just the game, not just the Bradish news and Coulomb news, but also kind of looking at, okay, I think you found out some things off the field health-wise, and I think, you know, with what we saw with Kimbrel and, you know, Capovich, he battled, wasn't pretty whatsoever, but he gave him a chance. But I think it's very clear they're going to need some reinforcements here now. I mean, that's an understatement at this point. At the same time, still a heck of a baseball team. They found a way to win on Wednesday night amidst the Yankees throwing at Gunnar Henderson and bad blood brewing. How about that? I came full circle for you right there.
There you go. All right. So we will be together at Costas later today, Thursday, if you're hearing this on Thursday. If you're hearing this on Friday, it was just a big mistake, and we hope they won on Thursday. Big weekend in Houston, and certainly next week we're going to be taking the Maryland Crab Cake Tour presented by the Maryland Lottery with the Gold Rush Sevens Doublers. We have these to give away at Costas. We'll have these to give away on Tuesday at Pappas in Parkville. We'll be there in the afternoon. We got great guests coming. Chris Emery's coming out today. Jessica Vallis, my dear friend from Hartford Designs, who's redesigned our website, which you can go check out at BaltimorePositive.com. And a rare opportunity to have a crab cake with Luke Jones. He will be there. I'm going to try to talk him into the Oysters Rockefeller and see if I can expand his palate into the Dundalk parlance. It's been a little while since Luke and I have gathered in Dundalk, so we will see you over at Costas, despite the fact that I'm wearing my El Guapo shirt in Catonsville. I am Nestor. He's Luke. We're WNST AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, bellied up to the bar at Costas at 4 p.m. today. Get on it.